Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, imagination, and, well, you know the rest. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning is Danny. Air date, May 9th, 2013, Iron Man 3, take one. Hey, I'm Dan Persons, your old friend from CFQOnline.com. Why haven't you written? So, we are talking about Iron Man 3 here, and I'll say...
Well, that's absolutely Catherine, the wrong one. She usually knows, intuits more about... how I should be doing this than I do. I'm just like, no, that's Iron Man. That's like his first review 3-4 years ago. Let's do the Neon Demon instead, shall we?
I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Fun fact about the Danish director Nicholas Winding Refn. I interviewed him a couple of times for a couple of his films, and each time he asked me what I thought of the film. Now, this is not like some kind of unwritten rule, but there are a number of reasons why that question usually doesn't get asked by a director to his or her interviewer. Journalists don't always cover the films they like. They sometimes are covering films they haven't even seen. That's just the nature of the business. Puts the interviewer in kind of an uncomfortable position. I liked both films, as a matter of fact, but had some problems with one of them and told him about that as delicately and awkwardly, admittedly, as possible. And to his credit, it looked like he was taking my comments into consideration, but who knows? And you can look at him asking that question in two ways. One is that it comes from an actual and courageous quest to understand the effects of his films on their viewers, or it could be an attempt to stroke his own ego, knowing those interviewing him are loath to say anything that might risk a premature end to the conversation. From my own limited time with him, I'm willing to think it's actually from the former option. He didn't seem to be particularly surprised or put out by my criticisms. But think about this. For his newest film, The Neon Demon, Refn has mused in interview about the possibility of there being a good side to narcissism. That's not necessarily a wrong thought. I mean, I'm not on the radio because I don't hold my opinions in high regard. But for a person whose films are as much about the interiors of his own thought processes as anything else, that's an interesting comment to make. And maybe a clue to the frequently split decisions audiences have had about his work, the best known of which is The Driver, but also include Bronson and the Pusher series. I was waiting in line for the bathroom after the screening of The Neon Demon, and a guy behind me said, "What a piece of bleep." Now, I like the film quite a bit, actually, but I'm not unsympathetic to his response. The Neon Demon is about a teenager played by Elle Fanning who runs away to become a model in Los Angeles. She not only succeeds, she becomes, in what seems at most a span of days, a fashion goddess, sought after by designers and photographers, male designers and photographers, and envied with a poisonous passion by her fellow models, played by Bella Heathcote and Abby Lee, among others. But The Neon Demon, by and large, is about narcissism, done by a director who includes his own self-regard as part of his toolkit. That makes you uncomfortable, you're going to have problems. This is being billed as Refn's first horror film, which is true on the surface, but actually BS on a deeper level. This is a Nicholas Winding Refn film, as all Nicholas Winding Refn films are. It is sui generis. His Los Angeles bears no resemblance to the real city, or even to the city as envisioned in the minds of its fashion elite. It's got some of the David Lynch sheen, but stripped of the noir grittiness. It's all gloss. The timeline, as I noted, is oddly compressed. A tonal shift in the third act that reveals the character's true natures is abrupt and awkward. It's like Refn wanted to do his take on the old tale of the rise and fall of a superstar, but have it all happen in less time than it takes to get a dress altered. It would be comic, and Refn does slip in some wry humor throughout. But this isn't meant to be satire, I think, which is fair enough reason to take it all in and say, "Oh man, you, sir, are so full of it." And in some ways, I do feel that way. Refn is so wrapped up in his own mind that it's hard not to. But I also like that. The films are undeniably beautiful to look at, and the passion is undeniable. It may be downright insane to imagine a scene where a mountain lion is set loose in a seedy motel room, but the sight is also electrifying in its mad intensity. I don't particularly buy anything Refn is selling, but I'm sure as hell glad to be able to listen to the pitch. The Neon Demon may outrage, but if you're willing to give its director his due, it is a trip worth taking. And just a note, if you can't get out to see your horror movies, they can now come to your home for free with the Monster Channel, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. 366 days, actually, this is a leap year. You can get it online or on your iOS devices by going to monsterchannel.tv or on your Roku devices by downloading the Monster Channel app. The Monster Channel, come scream with us. I'm Dan Persons. Now is the time to take a stand against hatred, fear, and greed. Register to vote and let's defeat Trump.
That's okay. As they're defeating Trump, we can talk about Skype so that Burn Baby Burn Clapper, coming your way in 90 minutes, will be all set up. So there we are. This place, let me tell you, no phones. In order for anybody to talk to anybody not in this building, they got to use Skype, which means also no conference calling. No this, no that, no good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. And before we can be blah, blah, bloop, before we begin the show proper, announcements. Yes, it's always time for announcements. The next New York Review of Science Fiction readings will be not next week, not the first Tuesday of the month. I always warn people that these things have flexibility in space and time, and we're going to keep the same space, but we're going to move to a different time for Space and Time Magazine, that is. And as I have been trying to tell attendees of the reading series, there's Space Magazine, and then there's Time Magazine, but this is Space and Time. It's better than both of them put together. Gordon Linsner, who's been a frequent guest on this program, and Hildy Silverman, who's been there but a mere two times, are the former and current editors of Space and Time magazine. And while the reading series is having its 25th anniversary, Space and Time magazine is having its 50th anniversary. Yes, that's right. They beat out Star Trek by like 3 months. So think on that. So in celebration of Space and Time magazine's 50th anniversary, then on July 12th, because I didn't want to do an event on July 6th following, you know, that close to, most people have the Monday off, or actually it would be the 5th, so it would be the day after the 4th of July. We just don't want to do that. It harms getting a good audience. So we move to the second Tuesday of the month, July 12th, and we never want to go the third Tuesday because KGB Fantastic Fiction is on the third Wednesday, and we don't want to confuse things. We want everybody to go to both readings, or as I like to put it, a great reading every fortnight. So the so July 12th is, and probably for the last NYRSF, New York Review of Science Fiction, is NYRSF, so NYRSF is how we say it. So the last NYRSF reading of this season is this one, July 12th. I wouldn't even have a July 12th reading if I hadn't wanted to, if I hadn't wanted to say to Gordon and Hildy, sure, yes, let's do something. If I can, I usually like to take July and August off, if I can. But it doesn't always work out that way. Somebody, you know, a publicist calls me up and says, you know, do you want to have Thomas Pynchon on? And it's like, oh, that guy, well, maybe, you know, something like that. You never know. Tom and I, well, we go back. So anyway, it's Lot 49, you know. I was in Lot 48 when he was in, never mind. So, July 12th, yeah, I've got that right. 388 Atlantic Avenue, I know that address because I'm there right now, except I'm on the third floor. This will be at the big cafe, the big door. You'll see it's open and everything on the ground floor. And the doors will be open actually all day, but I advise people come in about 6:30 for the 7 p.m. start. And to celebrate the 50th anniversary, we've got Linda D. Addison. Linda has been on this show any number of times. Daniel Brom, who's making his second appearance on this show sometime real soon. Catherine Hazel, or K.L. Hazel, actually I think it's Hazel, not Hazel, who is new to me. She's an animator, actor, writer, and editor who lives and works in New York City. She once made a weeping willow laugh. She never wears a watch because time is always on her side. This is her bio. I'm simply repeating what these people send me. And I must warn you in advance, these people are all writers. Beware. Be very, very aware. So, and Dallas Mayer, who's actually Jack Ketchum in fake life, but in real life, he's Dallas Mayer. Jack Ketchum is one of the top-selling horror writers and one of the creepiest, which is a good thing when you're a horror writer. But like all horror writers, he's one of the sweetest, nicest people. We'll ask Daniel about this in a while. But why is it that horror writers, you know, you'll never meet somebody nicer than Joe Hill or his father, whatever his name is. Gayon Wilson is just, you know, a charming, well-adjusted man. Robert Block was a delight. Richard Matheson, all these people. Sarah Langan, John Langan, Moishe Langan, all these people are, like, really cool, nice, sweet people. J.T. Petty, who happens to be married to Sarah Langan, who makes really, really creepy horror movies that I won't see because they're really gory and creepy and stuff. Max Schmid loves them, okay? PAR listeners, you know what I'm talking about then. You know, just, you know, brain opening, people scooping out brains and eating them. We're not even Spielberg territory here. This is gore, gore, gore. Anyway, and all those people that make this horrible stuff, they're wonderful folk. I think they exercise their demons in other ways. Okay, so that's the lineup. Hilde Silverman and Gordon Lindsner featuring Linda Addison, Daniel Brom, Catherine Hazel, Jack Ketchum, and on not exactly the sidelines, artist Alan Beck, Alan F. Beck, will be showing some of his artwork, several covers from Space and Time magazine. And by way of introduction, Gordon and Hilde will be interviewed so as to give it a structure in Barbara Krasnoff. Making her third appearance this year. No, this is not nepotism. Her third appearance this year at Nearsif Readings. Well, one, because she deserved it. The second, because she was part of the Clockwork Phoenix reading. And the third, because she was invited by, actually, to be one of the readers. She's been in Space and Time magazine with Fiction twice. But we all thought that, okay, that's just a bit much. So we bumped me as the interviewer, and we made her the interviewer. And that works out just fine. So, again, that's Tuesday, July 12th. Admission is free. We turn nobody away, but we do hawk for donations. And there's a $7 suggested donation, but it is free, free, free. So please do show up, no matter what your financial status may be. Let's see. Other announcements? Yeah, a small one. Chatting Science Fiction is a new audiobook that just came out. Its official publication date was June 14th, but my copy actually arrived in the mail this afternoon. And what makes this one different is that it's me. It's 15 hours of interviews from this very radio program, including Ray Bradbury and Ursula K. Le Guin and lots and lots and lots of folk. I don't know if I'm going to make any money from this. We never worked that out. But I don't care. It's ego, okay? It's ego. It's got my face on there. It says Hour of the Wolf on it. And that's what I have to ask you about sometime, Catherine, off the air, is so my CD is out. Oh, my audio book is out. I couldn't wait to see it. I got my copy today. It just arrived. Okay, can I help? Are we looking? We'll keep our eyes open. Yeah, aren't we all somewhere else? So that's the name of it, Chatting Science Fiction. You can go to downpour.com. Do me a favor, Daniel. Sit in the room. And downpour.com and at Audible and at Amazon, which is the same thing as Audible. And I won't mention prices or anything like that, but it's ego boo, as I say. And so I'm very, very pleased. I had a copy earlier that was the MP3 CD. You can also get it as a download. But now I actually got a tangible copy of the audiobook in my hot little hands. And that makes a difference. I trust, I don't know how it works, but I trust that we will be able to make copies of the audiobook, at least of the download, if not the physical audiobook itself, available to you, the listener, through WBAI. You know, in other words, donate to BAI and get a copy of the audiobook. Dan, it looks to me like you don't know how to use a mic. For one thing, pull it about a foot closer to you.
How's this, Jim?
It isn't open yet. Okay. Don't talk until it is open. That's a reasonable proximity, but you don't talk straight into it. You angle it like so, so that your cheek, no, toward you, toward your mouth. But no, back up. Now you see how this is angled at my mouth? Okay, no, aiming at your mouth, like it's, that's closer. Okay, now talk to me a little bit. For a sound check.
Good morning, Jim. How are you?
I am well, Daniel. Okay. So, Daniel Braun, what a coincidence. I got his most recent bio because he sent it to Gordon Linzer only last night, even though we published it 3 days ago. Daniel Braun is the author of the collection, recently released collection, The Night Marches and Other Strange Tales. He has a story forthcoming in Space and Time magazine. His website is Blood and Stardust, not to be confused with the novel Blood or the novel Stardust, which are by two different authors. That's why you can't confuse them. This is Blood and Stardust, so as we said, better together. Good morning.
Good morning, Jim.
So, so this year, this book has been how many years in the making, The Night Marchers?
Well, the stories appear as far back as 2004, since it's a collection. We've been working on it for the past year with my editor, Norman Prentice, over at Cemetery Dance.
Mm-hmm. Although that's not the name, that's actually, this is Gray Matter Press.
Yeah, well, the book was acquired by Cemetery Dance eBooks, which left the other set of rights open. And Gray Matter Press is a publisher.
Okay, careful. Look at me when you talk. If you talk into the mic when you say press, there will be an explosion of air that's called popping your pee. If you wear your headphones, you'll see what I mean.
Which set should I put on? This one right
here? Anyone. Whichever one looks the least filthy. Being WBAI, they're all little. So say Gray Matter Press again.
Gray Matter Press. Is that better?
That's fine.
I'm not hearing anything in these headphones.
Oh, well. Then either try another pair or...
Sure.
Or let's see if we can crank them. I see there's only two plugged in. Okay, that's this one over here. So how's that?
Gray Matter Press, is that pee popping? I'm not hearing anything in these headphones.
Okay, then forget the headphones.
Okay, but I'll still take that tip and I'll look at you.
Yeah, we only need headphones when we're taking phone calls, and we can't take phone calls!
So yeah, the Gray Matter Press came in. I was working with them on another project called Savage Beasts, which was a collection of music-themed science fiction stories. And I had a short story with them called An American Ghost in Zurich, which it's an interesting, it's one of the reasons I'm interested in Gray Matter Press is, you know, there's a skull on the book and Gray Matter Press has a spooky logo. And so they fancy themselves dark fiction and horror. But one of the things that attracted me to Gray Matter Press was they really encompass the wide definition of horror to include such hybrid orphan stories such as An American Ghost in Zurich, which
like at Nightmare Magazine, which I edit the podcast for, in, you know, it's dark fantasy and horror. It doesn't need to be horror. It just needs to be dark.
Mm. Yeah, and that's one of the things that excites me about publishers and the small publishers today. Cemetery Dance, Gray Matter Press. There's a lot of them out there that are really casting a wide net that can, at least for me, that gave these stories that have been out there in the world since 2000, some of them dating back to 2002, 2004, a home and perhaps a place in, mm-hmm. under this wide umbrella. Whereas, some of the stories appeared in publications as wide ranging as Electric Velocipede, which is, you know, that's not a horror publication by any means. I don't think their door was closed. They're very.
It is now.
their door is technically closed.
Not technically closed. Yeah. It's dead, Jim.
Yeah.
It's
dead, Jim.
John Klima is no longer publishing Electric Philosophy.
It's dead, Jim.
A fine Jim. Yes. Yeah. That was the joke, yes.
Some of the stories appeared in Electric Philosophy, the wonderfully named Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet.
Which nobody can say without hesitating. Because they have to make sure, let's see, do I have these in the right order? Is it Lady Churchill or is it Lady, different prime minister?
It's fun to say and even more fun to read.
Yeah, but no fun to submit to. Because their lead time is over 2 years.
Yeah, we were talking a little bit about that before we got on the air, just in terms of some people's stories and timings of when that comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you if their submissions are open right now, which I don't think they are, then between Kelly Link and Gavin Grant. Who are busy with other things often enough that Jedediah Barry is often doing the reading and editing, but their lead time, it's a slender magazine, and they only have so many stories to publish a month. They became super famous at one point when Kelly's star was on the horizon and reviewed in Time magazine and all that. And so now, if you were to sell them a story in this year, it would see publication late 2018, early 2019. And most writers aren't happy waiting that long for a publication in an independent press. Mm. I shouldn't diss this at all, because it's one of the great places to be published, which is why they get, such great stuff. So people should look at their website and find out what the current condition is.
Mm. I'd wait till 2018 or 2019, all decade long, even without the...
But you see, you can't submit that story anywhere else in the meantime. It's in limbo. And if you stood a chance of selling that story somewhere else, you can't. That's the problem.
Not arguing with the problem, but my personal choice, I'd wait that long and longer for the chance to do it all again.
Yeah, and then possibly get turned down. After all, that's the problem. They don't have the time to read all the submissions. I was a slush pile reader for Galaxy magazine, so I know way too much about that kind of thing. So I'm sorry I interrupted you. We were talking about the making of The Night Marchers. By the way, it's time to say this is WBAI New York, but go on.
Oh, okay, about the making of The Night Marchers. We were talking about where some of the stories, I guess when I was making The Night Marchers, I didn't know I was making The Night Marchers. I was... writing, like Jim said, I was writing fiction, putting it out there. Part of being a writer is, having the patience or the insanity or the confidence or lack of confidence to deal with submitting, and knowing that there are, part of the risks of publishing is knowing that there are these incredible lead times at the end of that Disneyland ride.
And when you're doing short stories into independent presses, which is now preferred to small press, independent presses, you're generally doing it without an agent.
Yeah, I most certainly was and am. Right now, I don't have an agent.
Well, put it this way, a good sale to an independent press might get anywhere from $50 to $400 if they're paying. A lot could be as much as $400. To an agent, that means they could get about $50 for about 2 weeks' work. Not a very good turnover.
Yeah. Agents
aren't big on that.
I don't think agents are very terribly interested in representing short stories or even short story collections on the main.
They are after your novel has been sold. Yeah. Then they'll look at it.
Then things change.
Very, very few people We were talking earlier about Karen Russell. She had a short story collection long before her first novel came out. But that's also because her stories were appearing in little places like The New Yorker, which is not a small independent press.
I've heard of that. I've heard of that one for sure. Yeah, so like by the time I was publishing these stories, I think the, you know, they perhaps the winds of publishing or the winds, or at least to my mind, have changed. Like I always felt like I never had a home in terms of I was thinking, well, what kind of a writer am I? I'm writing these stories. I'm following my muse. I'm following where I'm going, and the stories are appearing in places from the, you know, the now defunct Electric Velocipede, the now defunct Full Unit Hookup Zine, to the now, you know, the rising star of Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet. And most important to the collection, three of the stories appeared in Cemetery Dance magazine. And at some point, editor Norman Prentice asked, hey, how about we do a collection? And that was fantastic. And when we were discussing, well, what would these stories be? What would this collection look like? I'm a writer of science fiction, fantasy, and horror. I'm horror because, like, who was the person that said it? Was it Damon Knight?
I attribute the quote. Different people attribute it to different folk, but most people who ever went to Clarion always got from Damon Knight, science fiction is what I'm pointing at. And since he never gave an attribution, and we've never found it in print before that, I attribute it to Damon Knight.
I like that quote a lot. I mean, I feel like that's why I found a home in horror, and I found a comfort in categorizing myself in horror. Well, what's horror? Horror is whatever a particular publisher is pointing at.
You see, that's something that I've had a discussion with Ellen Datlow on the air about several times.
She's an authority
and
for sure.
She certainly is. And science fiction or speculative fiction or science fantasy or fantasy and any of these variants, those are open to definition and interpretation. Horror is an emotion, just like comedy. Horror is something that makes the reader feel horror, and therein lies the difference. Horror is actually very definable. Otherwise, it's dark fantasy, and then we get into the touchy-feely kind of thing again. Yeah. But horror itself is definable.
Yeah, I'm listening to that with open ears, because I am most certainly not an expert by any means. This is what is anything, at least to me, is an exploration, and I'm excited to explore that with you and to hear Ellen's definition of that.
And I hope I'm not misquoting, because if I am, Ellen is going to hand my butt to me at ReaderCon, which, well, anyway.
Yeah. No, whether horror is definable or indefinable or whatever the parameters are, I feel very grateful to have been published in Cemetery Dance, and very grateful to be published by Grey Matter Press, because I feel, definable or not, at least to me, from my very limited perspective as one reader and one writer, horror seems to be, whether it's an emotion or a mode, it seems to be the genre that perhaps, while all genres are wide open, it's the genre that's open enough or open wide enough to capture the stories that I'm writing, which at the very least are on the fringes or in between genres, whether intentionally or not. I think now as I'm matured as a writer.
And there's another word that people like, interstitial.
Yeah, that's a great word. I'm not sure who coined that one. I know, Sherman and Ellen.
Well, no, they use the word.
Yeah, they use
they
the
didn't
word.
Coin it at all, but they have the Interstitial Arts Foundation, which isn't just fiction. But interstitial, of course, is a medical term.
Oh, okay.
If it's not an artery or an organ or something like that, it's just that thing that's in between the various other parts of your body. That's interstitial. It's an actual medical term.
And what a great word it is, and how great it is to to describe fiction as interstitial. I mean, it certainly describes the fiction that excites me as a reader. It excites me as a writer. You, at your reading series, you just had, I think, perhaps one of the great examples of interstitial, the Clockwork Phoenix reading, that anthology champions interstitial works, for sure. Very exciting book with some very exciting authors.
Five books, yes.
Yes, exciting. So as going back to saying what's the creating of the Night Marchers, so I'm writing fiction and trying to find a home, or trying to classify it, and eventually I land with some stories in Cemetery Dance, and we're putting together this collection, and we're trying to define it, because we're like, okay, who's going to read this? What is our audience? And we came up with the moniker of it, The Night Marchers and Other Strange Tales, and that was included very intentionally. Again, I might be mangling origins, but at the very least, the term "strange tales" is very closely associated, if not coined, by the author Robert Aikman, who classified his tales way back when as strange tales. So, in the discussions about the book, I had very recently. I'm not the most well read. I'm embarrassingly not well read. I only learned about Robert Aikman's fiction back in 2014 at the World Fantasy Convention. There was a panel moderated by the author Simon Strances, and had some people on there, Peter Straub, Chelsea Quinn Yarbo, and they were discussing this author, Robert Aikman, and me, a writer in the audience, was just so very excited to hear about this Robert Aikman and his strange tales. And once I started reading Robert Aikman and hearing about the weird fiction and the weird fiction movement, it seemed like my writing
was a new weird fiction movement, as opposed to weird tales, which go back to the 30s.
Yeah,
because it's been recoined, and
definitely the recoining.
So,
for sure.
So when I say weird tales, I'm probably talking about something that's nearly a century old, in some cases older than that. So to distinguish it from the stuff that Jeff and Ann Vandermeer recoined, those weird tales, what people are now calling their weird tales, not the same as H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, oh, most certainly.
Or Clark Ashton Smith or Lord Dunsany, who were the original tellers of weird tales.
Yeah.
It's a different genre.
Most certainly not. Again, I'm an explorer.
I'm just being conversational.
Yeah, no, and a very exciting conversation to me, as in I'm not an expert. I'm an explorer, and so there's this weird, there's this new weird.
Which is the name of their collection, New Weird. It's a big book.
Yeah, and you've got
great
me,
book.
Yeah, and you've got me. If I could tell you what you've got, if it comes to definitions, I'm the wrong guy to talk to. But yeah, there is some, I think there is some connection, at least some of the writers, some of the people involved in the movement would link it back. I mean, one of the original...
Well, there are relations, of course. Yeah. They didn't choose that name out of nowhere, but it's really sort of a rebirth.
Yeah.
And therefore a, post, if there's such a thing as modern literature, then there's postmodern, then there's past postmodern. So this is sort of like post weird tale kind of stuff. It's really a different movement that has its roots in the old weird tales.
Absolutely.
But we shouldn't. You're going to read one
Absolutely.
Of the stories, and that's going to take half an hour approximately, a little less. Why don't we take a musical break?
Okay.
So I can set up your microphone for reading purposes.
Sure.
And we will be back in, let's say 2 minutes and 40 seconds at random.
Hey, we to the other world, boys, where 'tis thought they very merry be. There the man in the moon drinks claret to health, to thee, to me. Hey, we to the other world, boys, where 'tis thought they very merry be. boys.
This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, vibrating 99.5 million times every second, and also streaming over WBAI.org. It's like ARG, but it's with an O, so it's ORG. And that was, by the way, Hey We to the Other World by a very, very obscure group that Ellen Kushner turned me on to called Piawakit. And I also love the name of the group because Piawakit is probably my favorite cat out of genre cinema. Bell, Book, and Candle is the movie, and Kim Novak with purring at her cat, who in turn is purring at her. The cat's name is Piawakit, is where that comes from. Wonderful name. And I always thought they should do a musical version, by the way, of Bell, Book, and Candle, and the name of it should be Piawakit. Our guest this morning is Daniel Brom, whose new collection of stories is The Night Marchers and Other Strange Tales, and you're going to read from that.
Yes, sir.
And say that yes, sir, again.
Yes, sir. How's
okay.
that sounding?
No, that's fine. It's technical issues. Don't worry about it. But you're on mic now. And I don't know how Mike feels about that.
Hopefully I'm not popping him or hurting him.
No, you know, you're actually sounding good.
Good morning to you, Jim.
So tell us about this story you are going to read.
Yeah, this is a story called The Moon and the Mesa. It originally appeared back in 2010 in a publication called Midnight Echo. This was a publication of the Australian Horror Writers Association. This particular volume was edited by the author Lee Battersby. The story has since appeared in the wonderful Pseudopod podcast. They recorded a fantastic audio version of it. And now it appears in the Cemetery Dance ebook and the Grey Matter Press trade edition of The Night Marchers and Other Strange Tales. It's called The Moon and the Mesa.
Very good. So without further ado,
The Moon and the Mesa. Jamie and I have claimed a little bit of elbow room. I can't hear her or anyone very well, but that's okay. The bartender has his eye on her, as do most of the showboats drinking $20 cocktails at the bar. She's dressed down for her, but even still, I'm very aware of her simple black top that doesn't even come close to hiding her curves. We're silent, people watching, together. The wordless space between us is comfortable and familiar. The extension of a frankness and trust, born of being drunk as sin together, more times than I can count. My hands remember how they want to touch her, but as always, they stay at my side, obediently under the dominion of my mind, my higher self, despite the alcohol. Two guys at the bar are staring right at her, both tall and blonde, their crisp shirts tightly tucked into the whale-tailored dark slacks. This bar is full of Eurotrash like them. It's why she brought me here. Midtown on a Saturday is always good for hunting. Jamie's noticed their stares and encourages them with her smile. They come over. I didn't even have to say a word. "You from here?" Tall and Blue Eyes asks her. "Why do you ask?" She tosses a ringlet of her long black hair. They laugh and mutter something quickly in German. "I'm Heinrich, and this is Klaus. Klaus wants to know if this is your boyfriend." "My boyfriend? Oh, no, no, no." She touches my arm. "Just my friend David, and he looks thirsty. Klaus, why don't you go get us around?" She plays with the silver chain disappearing beneath her shirt, like she always does when it begins. I used to think it was just a flirty habit, until the first time I saw the silver star of David. Must be from her grandparents. Looks very old country. I never asked. I never needed to. "So, are you New Yorkers?" Heinrich asks. He so wants to tell us he is traveling. He's dying to tell us all about what it's like for him to be in New York. I've seen it 100 times before. For a second, I almost feel bad. But a childhood image of my grandmother prevents me. A thin line of drool hangs from the corner of her mouth as she sits blankly on the couch in the house I grew up in. Often she'd spend the night during the high holy days, and when I'd get up in the night for water or to sneak a cookie, I'd catch her unplugging appliances and asking the refrigerator questions about guard locations. Sometimes she'd just go on in Yiddish, her eyes all freakily far away. "Where do you think we're from?" Jamie asks.
Here, New York, of course," he says.
"Nope." Jamie and I laugh. He doesn't get it. He can't. There's nothing funny about it, except him and the way she said it. I've been worried about her lately, and there's something different about the way she laughs tonight. Like the start of a twisted belly laugh she won't be able to stop. After a second, he laughs too, pretending to get it. His eyes dart to the line of skin showing between her shirt and her jeans. "Where do you think I'm from?" Jamie starts to talk, but I interrupt. I'm more than worried about her taking it too far. Tonight I want to be the one.
"Wait, wait, wait," I say. I know, don't tell me. I have it between two places.
"Just say," he says.
I'm not sure. Say something like Florida oranges. Say the rain in Spain falls mainly on the plain.
He does. He's enjoying it. We're enjoying it more. Klaus is back with our drinks, trying to figure out what he missed.
"F, I'm so close," I say. "It's right on the tip of my tongue. Okay, whatever. New Jersey."
His face is still smiling, but the cheer has left.
"There?" he asks.
"New Jersey, around Hoboken, right?" Jamie's disappointed. I can tell she wanted to keep it going longer, all the way back to her apartment. "I was thinking Jersey City," Jamie says, stirs her pink drink, tastes it, then licks her lips.
"No," he says, his smile now a forced grin. Damn, I should have gone with my second guess. Nashville, right? I should have heard that Tennessee accent right away. No, I'm from Hamburg. Klaus is from Vienna. Really, Jamie says? You look like Jersey boys. They stare, not sure what to say. I turn my back to them and make mindless small talk with Jamie. I make it a point to touch her shoulders, her arms, her back with every sentence. After a minute, Klaus and Heinrich meld back into the crowd of showboaters. Jamie's pleased. Our stupid trick slams their type every time. But I know this wasn't why she came. That was great, she says, and leans in for a kiss. Her mouth barely touches mine. Her lips don't mean it. She doesn't mean it. It's just another song and dance, steps in a connect the dots that is supposed to form a picture of normalcy, but never does. Beneath, I suspect she's nothing. Nothing but something very broken, with no idea how to even begin to reassemble. I don't even want to think about what that makes me then. Effing Nazis, she says in my ear. But it was too fast. Didn't you want to take them home? Her new Glock is at home. She keeps it on her pillow, its angles and blackness obscene among the plush getup, like a sex toy among teddy bears. She tells me about it when we talk on the phone, and I sense her staring at it when she's supposed to be listening. Someday soon, she's going to use it. She's right. It was over too fast. We've done much, much better, but I thought that someday soon might have been tonight. We push our way through the hot maze of cologne bodies and emerge into the relative quiet of the street. She fishes in her purse, but instead of taking out a pack of cigarettes, she pulls out the little black gun. She holds it up, admiring it in the streetlight. Didn't you want to take them home? Didn't you want to... Ah, F, what the hell are you doing with that? Don't take it out here. I snatch the gun and stuff it back into her purse. Hey, easy there, she says. Don't you dare tell me you're not going to. You said. She's much too calm. It's that calmness that scares me. I know, I said I'm going to, and I am. When then? Tomorrow? I already called Larry. He's in. Not tomorrow, but soon. Real soon, for real. I promise. Take it, then. She kisses me. This time, for real. And she deftly slides the gun into the waist of my slacks. It feels horrible against my skin, but I let it stay, savoring the floral shampoo smell of her hair and her hot alcohol breath on my ear before she pulls away. Larry flips through my stack of pictures, stopping at a black and white landscape of a lonely mesa. That's a good one, Larry says. Is it? I ask. Yeah, F yeah. This is where he tends bar. I brought Larry because he is strong, a black belt now, and smart, but just dumb enough to listen to me. We're both in from the city for Rosh Hashanah, family obligations. What the hell are you doing out there? Larry asks. Dworkin was looking for the place on the map furthest away from everything. The place farthest away from the city. The place with the least sky glow so we could see the stars. He wanted to fulfill a dream to lay on his back in the middle of the night in the desert and play the guitar as loud as he could. I wanted to take pictures, so I was in. That's what I say, but really I was doing everything I could to avoid coming here. Now that I'm back, Jamie's having no more excuses. Dworkin found the place on the map, a secluded campground near the reservations on the Arizona-Utah border. He said to meet him in the airport in Flagstaff. He'd take care of the rest. He rented a little Honda 4x4 and packed it full of his instruments, camping gear, and a gas generator. The place on the map turned out to be a crowded trailer park. So much for the power of AAA. I mean, we were so freaking tired, we just drove on in, pulled into our spot, and we went to sleep.
We woke up in the morning and realized we were surrounded by RVs. What a nightmare.
That must have sucked, Larry says.
It did. So we just rolled on, figuring we'd hit the scenic drive through Monument Valley, cruised the res, and found a new spot. Highway 166 turned into County Road 75 and took us into the heart of the res. Signs admonished that we were leaving the U.S. of A. and entering Navajo land, and to stay on the road unless given permission. The road snaked into the deep, wide chasm that is Monument Valley, a white line weaving into hundreds of ancient red rock formations. Two Native American dudes waited at a roadblock, a 2x4 laid across the road, collecting a toll. We paid and followed the road and pulled off at the most awesome little vista as it began to wind its way down. Two minibuses took up all the spaces in the small parking area. A few dozen wheelchair-bound people were jostling into position for a group photo. Two aides were helping them line up. One of them, a blonde in denim shorts and a white cut-off shirt, was walking backwards, looking into a camera instead of where she was going. Dworkin hit the brakes, but she walked right into us. "Move," she said to Dworkin, along with something in German I took to be curse words. "Dworkin sprechen Sie Deutsch?" Larry asks. "No. But you know Dworkin. He doesn't like to be told what to do. So I told him just to chill, get his guitar, and to trust me. I jumped out of the car and asked the woman if she'd like to get in the photo. The wheelchair crowd was watching the exchange like a television program. She handed the camera over to me. Since I couldn't fit them all in the frame, I climbed on top of the Honda, noisily going right over the hood and onto the roof. They all cheered. And it was a hell of a photo. The blonde, all the wheelchair-y people, and in the background, one crazy-ass bird's-eye view of Monument Valley and its majestic mesas and winding roads snaking into the corners of Navajo country. It's the kind of sight that makes you believe in God. So Dworkin lightened up and is posing for pictures with everyone, hamming it up, doing Elvis impersonations and windmills on his guitar, just getting them to be silly and shit. The German chick is having a smoke behind the bus. She's staring at this mesa. Effing beautiful. The mesa, like Devil's Tower from Close Encounters. A flat top, sloping sides, all red rock, the shadows constantly shifting, and the tones changing as the clouds cross the sky. "That was good," she says. She's enjoying her cigarette like it's her last. She looks me up and down and wasn't shy about it. Really casual and unashamed like Europeans are. I could sense her sizing me up, deciding what to think. I wished I wasn't covered in sweat and all the red dust that was everywhere. "That was very good for them," she says. "They loved it." "How long's the show been going on the road?"
2 months.
"We're heading to Disneyland and flying back to Germany out of L.A. Just came from the Grand Canyon."
"F," I said. "2 months? I've only got 2 weeks.
"F is right. You Americans need to learn to take more time."
"It's been good?"
"I get to see the States for free, but not a lot of people to talk to. Eye to eye." "Where are you staying?"
"Not sure. Somewhere around here, we hope. My friend brought his guitar to play out here in the middle of nowhere. I'm going to take pictures."
"Cute," she says. The fine white hairs on her stomach are coated with red dust. She has a faded scar running along the left of her. I wonder if it was a C-section. "They're up at the lodge at the little tourist trap up the road. Just for tonight. I'm sharing a room with the other two, so you can't meet me there."
"I'd invite you for a drink or something, but well, you know, can I buy you a water?"
"Just meet me at the mesa. Tonight. After midnight."
"I'd hang with you guys more often if I knew you rolled like this," Larry says.
"Okay, so why don't you?"
"I don't know. Work. And I've been the one stuck taking Grandpa to effing chemo."
Larry's grandfather escaped from Dachau and then went back, became part of the Underground Railroad smuggling escapees into Italy. I remember when Spielberg's people came to the city to interview him and other survivors. He's become so small, Larry says. The bartender looks over. It's him. No doubts at all. I can feel the blows in my gut. See his face as a boy standing over me. It wasn't easy for Larry and I, being the only Jews in our grade. And there never was any other reason needed to chase us after school. Sometimes they'd catch me. That's him, right? Larry says. Yeah. You sure? Yep. We gonna do this? Yeah. All right. A couple more beers then. We wait till it empties out. Okay. I think of Jamie out hunting in the city without her new gun, and the unlucky effer who thinks he's found a hot date. Larry's putting him away to mask his nervousness. I keep the beer flowing and the story going to prevent any second thoughts. So we leave the overlook and cruise on into the valley. We spend the day looking at stuff and taking photos. Dworkin's getting antsy and has his guitar on his lap in the front seat. There really isn't any place to camp, and we're not supposed to just pull off on the side of the road, but come late afternoon, we pull off anyway. Dworkin has to piss and runs off behind a big rock. I walk a ways up the road with my camera. There's a fence and a little stable. This white horse is absently flicking its tail at flies in its shade. I raise my camera to take a shot and notice there is a man in a 10-gallon white hat standing in the shadows. The hat and his clothes are stained red from sand. "Didn't see you there. Sorry," I say. "Can I take a photo?" He emerges from the shed without answering. He's a white guy, or maybe he once was. His old skin's wrinkled, leathery, and tan, and marked with spots of age. His shirt is stretched thin to its fibers. "I don't know," he says. His mouth is almost toothless. "I shouldn't let you, but it's been a dry one. The horse needs hay and all." I think about this for a second. "I don't have any hay, but how about a couple of bucks?" "That'd be fine, fella." I hand him a couple of bills and snap the picture of the horse. Dworkin has come out from behind the rock. "What you boys doing here?" "Looking for a place to stay. He wants to play his guitar as loud as can be in the middle of the desert. I'm going to take pictures." "Electric guitars? You boys got power?" "Yep, a generator. He thought of everything." "All this land is in the care of my boss, Mr. Yiskill. I suppose maybe if you had some gas money or whatnot, it'd be okay for you to stay. You don't look like trouble. I could ask him." "Sounds good. Okay, then, be right back." He disappears behind the shed and a few seconds later pulls out in the rickiest pickup truck you can imagine. It arcs across the desert, throwing up clouds of red sand behind it. It's just a faraway speck when it stops. I can make out a little trailer in the distance. Three vultures are high overhead, sweeping around the mesa in long, lazy circles. Small holes are everywhere at the bases of all the cacti. Snake holes, spider holes, homes for the world of things that come alive at night. 15 minutes later, the pickup returns. Our host steps out of it and leaves the door open. The most beautiful long feather hangs from the rearview mirror. It's white and flecked with a dozen shades of brown, like from an owl. An eagle, maybe. "My boss don't think you're here for the music, but that's okay. You can play as loud as you like. Won't bother nobody. He hopes you find what you're looking for in the desert. You can't sleep under the moon in Mesa and not be changed. But pitch your tent anywhere you like." In the distance, I see a man standing motionless by an old trailer. Mr. Yiskill, maybe. I sense I am in the presence of something very, very old and primal. Not just the ancient stone. I feel it watching. For a second, I envision Jamie and I returning here, holding hands, smiling in a normal way. If anyone gives you any trouble, just say you have the permission of Mr. Yiskill, and you're under his protection. You know, sometimes guys get drunk and might pull that white man can't be here shit on you. Remember to say that. I pull out a 50 from my wallet. Dworkin takes out a 20. That's a lot of gas money. Mr. Yiskill will be pretty happy. I hand the bills to him. My father places a few dollar bills in my hand for my brother and me. Crisp ones. Good for the vending machines in the basement. We spend every other Sunday at the home where Grandma is. I hate it there. Even the ocean right across the boardwalk, the tons of bleach and antiseptic can't mask the smell of old, sick bodies. I have to kiss Grandma hello and stay for a few minutes. Then I'm free to go. Grandma usually sits blankly, drooling, her old clothes smelling of mothballs, her scraggy white hair barely combed. Sometimes we play gin rummy. She's good at gin rummy. She calls out, "Rummy!" in a thick Russian accent. Today, she is waiting for us at the door, her coat on, her bag packed. "How can you bring the kids here, to such a place like this?" she says to my father. She grabs my wrist and runs. The strength of her grip surprises me. "Let her go, don't scare her," an orderly says. She turns the corner and tries to hide us in the janitorial closet. She's muttering the Shema prayer. Does she think we're going to die? I see the green tattoo of numbers on the inside of her arm, just above her wrist. I don't want them to touch my skin. My arm is red and mottled with little bumps from so much sweating. The heat of the day has gone with the sun, vanished with the warm wind sweeping from the mountains into the valley, a wake-up call to the sleeping creatures of the night. The air is alive with bats. Coyotes prowl on distant mesa tops. I don't see them, but I sense them waiting for the rising moon, and I want to hear the one howl like the movies. "No glove, no love," Dworkin taunts as I leave to hike to the mesa. Then he gets serious. "I need this time, thanks. But come back later. I'd love a photo or two." The moon rises over the mesa, drenching the night in a white glow. The cacti, the scrub, a steer skull with broken horns, a shell of a pickup truck, half buried in red sand. They all take on new starkness and poignancy. Being here, I feel I am like them, a survivor. Even if I've done nothing else to earn it, besides being born. This close to the mesa is a huge monolithic fist rising from the earth. It dwarfs me and the sea of cactus and all the creatures who run the course of their lives at its feet. With the oppressive heat gone, the desert is alive with life. Things can flourish in the night. Movement is everywhere. Kangaroo rats scurry to and from their holes. Coyote disappear among the cactus, and I hear them yipping and snarling somewhere else nearby. Things rustle in the scrub. Lizards and snakes. I try to watch where I step. A shiny black scorpion crosses my path with a lizard twice its size impaled on its stinger tail. Without the noise of the city, without my ringing phone and the bombardment of ideas from billboards and TV, I notice that the world is a quiet place. I sense their absence. The open road has opened some place in my mind. Dworkin's chords echo off the mesa. I wonder if I could ever convince Jamie to come here with me. I wonder what my grandmother would have looked like had she lived till a ripe old age. Would my family still be in Europe if it weren't for the war? If so, what would have become of me? Someone is sitting on a big rock at the foot of the mesa. I close the distance and realize it is a thick cactus, its spiky arms emulating a ragdoll human shape in the shadows and moon glow. Then I see her, the German girl.
She's on a plateau, just up the slope. She's wearing the same white shirt and shorts, not a speck of red dust anywhere. Her legs are crossed, and she's leaning back on her arms. She's as motionless as the cactus. I feel myself get excited. Then I stumble. My vision wavers and threatens to go black. I should have brought more water. I climb the slope and park myself next to her on the rock. With the change of vantage, I can see the maze of cactus and rock, the nighttime city. The moon glow has smoothed over her scar. The tiny lines around her eyes are gone. I want to hear her talk, hear her accent. What are you thinking? I say to get her talking. She shakes her head no and places her finger over her lips. The movement is meticulous and as fluid as an ant cleaning its mandibles. Her breasts are fuller than I remember this afternoon, her legs longer, smoother. There's not a drop of sand on her. That sense of proximity to primal oldness fills me, and like that, I realize she's not the German girl. I try to scoot away, but I am frozen. It looks just like her, whatever the F it is. Its pretty, blonde-haired head slowly turns, fluidly, not a drop of movement from the rest of her. Am I talking to myself? Am I like my grandmother, mad and talking to things that no one else can see? Green numbers appear on her moon-white skin. The arm becomes Jamie's, and now it is Jamie sitting next to me. She's caressing her gun as if it were a lover's hand. No, you're not crazy, the Jamie thing says. What's crazy about wanting to make them suffer? Don't you want to kill them all? Dworkin's chords erupt into an obscene, grinding riff. The moon is just above the mesa top, a perfect round companion to its unyielding square-topped form. Now I see my grandmother. The smell of her is too real. Mothballs and bleach and stale fish and sweat and drool. I'm tired of this, I say. I want to stop fighting. So stop, it says. It doesn't sound like my grandmother at all. It sounds like some bird from the zoo that has learned how to talk. Her mouth is black, and inside something glows like a far away star. Thorny spines poke from her flesh. Her skin shines like a scorpion's in the moonlight. She takes my hand. Her grip is stronger than I expect. She pulls me to her kiss and tastes bitter like fried cactus. My heart races, and I think I am going to be swallowed and die, my bones left to be covered by the sand. But I can't stop kissing it. And as I do, I'm filled with the oddest notion that a scorpion isn't evil. It just is. It stings and kills because it is its nature. I wonder if what Jamie does is her nature, and if what she wants me to do and why I have come here tonight is mine. No, it's just a justification. It's all wrong. Nothing changes that. Then I remember Mr. Yiskill, and I break away. I'm here with Mr. Yiskill, I say. I have his permission. It smiles. Then I am sitting alone. Just a thorny ragdoll cactus next to me. I look away and see a woman climbing the slope. The German girl. She's in a cut-off jeans and purple Mexican poncho. Here with who? The German girl says, climbing up the rocks. Yiskill knew it would boil down to she and I. This is why I am here. Alone. I feel like I am the scorpion now, but I get the sense I'm still being watched. But the cactus thing, the looming mass of Mesa, its eyes. Guess you've been waiting long? Looks like you need an F even longer than me. I start to ramble. She tells me to shut up. She takes my hand. Hers is solid, but surprisingly tender. Her skin slightly damp with sweat, welcomingly cool on my burnt skin. Somehow I know whatever it is that is watching cares about nothing that has or will happen here.
the drama of my life meaningless as another lizard succumbing to a poison sting. I sing along with Dworkin's chords in the distance. Your friend sucks, she says. A mechanical crackle disrupts the riff, and one final guitar chord rings out and fades into the canopy of sound that is the desert night. An owl lifts silently from its perch on a cactus at the foot of the mesa, a squirming mouse in its talons. This is where Jamie would turn it around. This is where Jamie would take her down. This is where we kiss. I roll on top of her, press her shoulders onto the ground. Her hands dig into my back. We shed her clothes, our clothes, two more creatures of the desert naked in the sand. Our sounds drown in the crackles of Dworkin unplugging his guitars. Last call went out, and the last of the patrons slipped out of the exit. It's just Larry and me and him. Larry's good and drunk. So am I. So you have to, right? And let her go, right? The bartender looks over at us and walks over, cradling three beers. I shoot Larry a look that says, get ready. David, Larry, thought it was you two, he says. We're closed, but I can stay open for one more. That it is if I can join you. Larry's face is red, but not from the alcohol. He's remembering school, his grandfather, the effed up world. Me a part of it. The biggest part of it right now. He'd rather be anywhere but here. I know. Yet here we are. A text pops up on my phone. It's from Jamie. Did you do it yet? Tell me. XOXO, J. How long's it been? The bartender asks and swigs a beer. Heard you went off to college. In the city. As a child, I couldn't forget his name. The leader of my tormentors. Now I can't remember it. Jamie's gun feels horrible against my skin. I want that feeling to go away. I'm tired of it. I'm sorry, you know. I'm really sorry, he says. Ingenuously. I was such a stupid kid. My hands ache to feel the weapon, to free it from my waist and fire. But I believe him. I'm sorry too, I say. And he's saying something. Talking with Larry, but I'm back at the mesa, looking into the blackness of that thing's mouth, watching the German girl trudge away from the ancient rock, back towards her lodge. I remember how I stifled one last urge to follow, one last urge to surrender to the scorpion's nature, but then let her disappear into the alien, moonlit landscape of the desert night.
No regrets, Coyote. We just come from such different sets of circumstance. I'm up all night in the studios and you're up early on your ranch. You'll be brushing out a broodmare's tail while the sun is ascending, and I'll just be getting home with my real material. There's no comfort. Just how close to the bone and the skin and the eyes and the lips you can get. And still feel so alone and still feel related. Like stations in some relay, you're not a, a hit and run driver, no, no. Racing away. You just picked up a hitcher, prisoner of the white lines on the freeway. A farmhouse burning down in the middle of nowhere, in the middle of the night. We roll right past that tragedy till we turn into some roadhouse lights where a local band was playing. Locals were up kicking and shaking on the floor. The next thing I know, that coyote's at my door. He pins me in a corner and he won't take no. He drags me out on the dance floor and we're dancing close and slow. Now he's got a woman at home. He's got another woman down the hall. He seems to want me anyway.
have to get so drunk and leave me on that way. You just picked up a hitcher, a prisoner of the white lines on the freeway.
I will remind you all that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. My guest this morning, Daniel Brown. You just heard reading a short story from his new collection, The Night Marchers and Other Strange Tales, just out from Gray Matter Press. So we only have, like 2 minutes left, believe it or not. But where did that story come from in brief?
Well, in brief, that was, it's definitely a Southwest U.S. story. I used to live out there and inspired
that's
by...
That's why you recognize the song so instantly, probably.
Inspired by some time in Navajo land. We only have a brief amount of time, and I know you've got stuff to get to, Jim.
No.
Oh, okay.
We're just good. Outro the stuff to get to.
Oh, okay.
The stuff to get to is exactly,
me.
Yeah.
Is me. Yeah, no, I'm definitely inspired by that part of the country, Navajo land, the Four Corners. I'm inspired inspired by what it's like to be out there by, you know, Joni Mitchell singing a little bit about the desert roads and the highway. And we're here in New York. We're here at WBAI. We're here in Brooklyn. And sometimes we forget what primal things are out there, and it could unlock certain things in us.
I would say that's a very primal story. It certainly qualifies as such.
Thank you.
So let's see. Oh, we should reiterate that you are going to be one of several readers at the next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings, which is July 12th. Here at 388 Atlantic Avenue, people should show up about 6:30. Festivities claim they'll start at 7, but they never do. But nevertheless, you get here early.
It's just a wonderful place.
Yeah, just because we start late is no excuse for you to show up late. So this is outro time already. So let me say, this has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you for listening. Ken Gale will be here next week hosting the program with his variant on Hour of the Wolf, Nuff Said. And he concentrates a lot on comics, and by that we don't mean stand-up. Okay, it's a different subgenre of the fantastic field. And like I don't necessarily always deal with the movies and TV, he doesn't deal with, well, necessarily the Marvel Cinematic Universe. He deals with people who work with Josh Kirby and, you know, non-entities like that. If you don't know what I'm talking about, don't let it batter you. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. As I said, next week, Ken Gale. After that, who the F knows? Because it will be another fundraising time here at BAI. Yes, yes, Lister, yes. It never stops. It never effing stops. Everybody, be good to each other. You all deserve it. We all deserve it. Have a good time. I will. I'll be at ReaderCon. And until then, take good care. Good morning.
red, white, and blue and spit on you.
Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth that's off the way I see it? Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right in this writing. The Constitution, yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others take the same turn. Like me, they yearn for the flag too.
Learn. sing me goodbye. Keep the dance all swinging with your disco 45. Now there's a posse in the corner requesting Strictly the Boy.
Doty, doty, road, it's a doty, doty.